Next, we'll remember an author who created his own world by bringing to life the anxieties of the world we share. Michael Crichton was best known for Jurassic Park, The Andromeda Strain, and other thrillers about science gone wrong. He died of cancer at age 66. He leaves behind books that sold millions of copies and sometimes became blockbuster movies. Here's NPR's Lynn Neary.
Michael Crichton was supposed to become a doctor, but somewhere along the line he left science behind in favor of science fiction. While still a medical student, Crichton began writing paperback novels under pseudonyms in order to earn extra money. Then, as he explained in an NPR interview, something started happening.
Instead of writing thrillers to pay for my term bills, I was actually now going to medical school in order to have something to write about. We would all be standing around a patient with our instructor, and everybody would be making notes about the patient, and I would be making notes about the doctors.
In Crichton's fictional world, science and technology have a way of going awry. In his first big hit under his own name, The Andromeda Strain, a deadly microorganism brought to Earth aboard an American space probe threatens a small town. In Prey, the threat comes from nanotechnology. And in Jurassic Park, it's dinosaurs brought back to life by ancient DNA.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh.
Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
A number of Crichton's books were made into films, which led to a career in Hollywood as a screenwriter and producer. In 1994, he used his background in medicine to create one of the most enduring TV shows ever, the hospital drama ER. Crichton courted controversy in the scientific world with his critique of global warming, the subject of his 2004 book, State of Fear. But as he told NPR, he never lost his interest in scientific discoveries.
There is an idea of, you know, informing people about some emerging things, and part of that is just a reflection of my own interest, following different areas and saying, you know, look what they're doing now. I mean, this is really interesting. You know, there's this guy in Australia who's getting DNA fragments out of fossils. Hey, all right.
Crichton's death came after what his family described as a private and courageous struggle with cancer. In announcing his death, the family called him a great storyteller who challenged our preconceived notions about the world around us. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The year is 1838. The opium trade rages. The trade route starts in northern India, and that's where Amitav Ghosh begins his new novel, Sea of Poppies. This is a landscape of flowering poppy fields and hellish opium factories.
They were bare-bodied men, sunk waist-deep in tanks of opium, tramping round and round to soften the sludge. Their eyes were vacant, glazed, and yet somehow they managed to keep moving, as slow as ants in honey, tramping, treading. When they could move no more, they sat on the edges of the tanks, stirring the dark ooze only with their feet.
Sea of Poppies is an epic tale with an epic cast of sailors, rajas, indentured servants, opium addicts, and struggling poppy farmers. They're all passengers on an old slave ship called the Ibis. Amitav Ghosh tells us where they're heading.
The Ibis is on its way to Mauritius. And it's just a few years since slavery has been finally banned in Mauritius. So the plantation owners in Mauritius are busy looking around for some other substitute labor. And Indian indentured workers are the substitute.
This ship is full of people who fall into strikingly different categories and castes. This is, after all, colonial India. Would you just introduce us to some of the principal characters on board the Ibis, please?
Sure. You know, first of all, there's Aditi, who's a woman. She's a young farmer. She's been recently widowed. And now she's managed to make her escape from her village where she was bound for some sort of terrible fate. And she and her rescuer, Kalua, they are for me in some ways the sort of main mast of the book. And it's their journey that really carries the book along.
And Kalu, I just want to point out, is a massive guy. And he saves her from committing sati, where a widow would throw herself on a funeral pyre in a very amazing way. And then there is, for me, a character who is in some ways the most fascinating, because many people are changing on this ship. And one of them is Neil.
Yes, well, Neil is actually one of the few characters in this book who's actually based upon a real-life person. While I was doing research for this book and so on, I came across various forgery cases in Bengal. And there was one man, a Raja, who was extremely sort of successful, was always busy entertaining the Englishmen and the whole city and so on. And then it was in 1829, he was hauled up in front of a court for forgery. And just reading about it and thinking about this character, I began to think of what would actually happen to a young, gently brought up Indian Bengali of that period who suddenly found himself being transported across the sea.
So things like that actually did happen in British East India. Someone of Raja status could literally be given a show trial, thrown in prison, and stripped of all of his lands.
Yes, there were many such instances.
Amitav Ghosh, you have such a stew of languages and dialects and sea of poppies. Most of the novel is done in a very intricate vocabulary. I'm not even sure what you call it, but it goes from pidgin into something else. How do you describe it, and where did you get it?
Well, any 19th century sailing ship was an incredibly cosmopolitan kind of unit because, there would be sailors from all around the world. And it was especially so in the Indian Ocean. So what actually happened is that they developed this kind of language of command. And this language was called Laskari. And I was very fortunate in that I actually managed to track down a dictionary of Laskari, which was written in 1812 by an Englishman and published in Calcutta. And I really followed that dictionary very closely, in fact.
There's all kinds of wonderful nouns like dumb cow and malam instead of mate, sarang for bosun, tyndal for bosun's mate, sea cunny. Do you have a favorite phrase?
I love dumb cow. It's actually from the Indian word dumb cow, which means to scold. But one thing I should point out to you, though, which you probably will not believe, but which is absolutely true, is that most of these words are in the Oxford English Dictionary. English in the 19th century was actually much more open to Asian influences than is the case today.
Mm-hmm. Back on board the Ibis, where Didi has fled, a dying woman gives her some poppy seeds. And it's an odd gift because the opium trade has so oppressed her. Maybe you could take us onto the deck with Didi looking at these seeds in her hand with a reading from your book.
She looked at the seed as if she had never seen one before. And suddenly she knew that it was not the planet above that governed her life. It was this minuscule orb, at once beautiful and all-devouring, merciful and destructive, sustaining and vengeful. This was her Shani, her Saturn. When Kalua asked what she was looking at, she raised her fingers to his lips and slipped the seed into his mouth. "Here," she said, "taste it. It is the star that took us from our homes and put us on this ship. It is the planet that rules our destiny."
The ship is a horrible place to be, but your characters are constantly interacting, and there's a lot of tenderness that goes on. I almost had the sense that you could hear these people speaking. Did you hear their voices in your head as you were writing?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I did. And, Jackie, one point you made, which is really so spot on, is that these people are traveling in the most appalling circumstances. I mean, it beggars belief. And yet, when I was reading accounts of these voyages, and these were accounts written mainly by Europeans, one thing they constantly point to in relation to, say, Indian indentured workers and Chinese indentured workers is that they were always singing. They were singing, they were laughing. And I think this is an aspect of the story which really resonates for me, that, the incredible resilience that people are able to find in suffering. And I think it has something to do with the ability to create communities, to spontaneously create communities and to see each other through.
Amitav Ghosh, his new novel is called Sea of Poppies. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you so much for having me.
You can read an excerpt of Sea of Poppies on our website, npr.org. Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Barack Obama's win has already jump-started one small sector of the economy, his books. Over the weekend, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father were the hottest sellers at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. Amazon actually ran out of hardcover and paperback editions of Audacity of Hope yesterday. While you wait, the online retailer lists over 24 other books now out about the president-elect. It's Morning Edition.
60 years ago, President Harry S. Truman signed a law that allowed women to become full, permanent members of the U.S. Armed Forces. Some 350,000 women serve in active and reserve duty today, but their stories are rarely told. In a new book to be released on Tuesday, Veterans Day, dozens of women veterans have written poems and essays about their heroic and sometimes brutal service. The book is called Powder, Writing by Women in the Ranks from Vietnam to Iraq. Some of the content is very graphic, including a passage that contributor Charlotte Brock will read in this segment. Brock is a former officer in the Marine Corps and is in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Leanne.
Your essay is called Him, and it was written about your first deployment. First of all, tell us the circumstances that inspired it, a little bit about your deployment.
I deployed in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom from February to September 2004. I was assigned to the 1st Force Service Support Group. I was a communications officer in communications company, and our job was to set up communications on the main logistics hub of the Anbar province, which is where Marines operated.
Mm-hmm. And you were with the Mortuary Affairs Unit for some time?
I ended up kind of by chance spending some time with that unit. I befriended the officer in charge, and just by hanging out with him and the Marines there, I ended up helping out.
And the essay Him was inspired by that experience.
Yes, it was.
Will you read just an excerpt for us? You have it in front of you.
Sure. I pulled IVs out of their veins as gently as I could. I knew it was crazy, but I didn't want to hurt them. I cut off socks and looked at dead feet and toes. I saw holes in every part of their bodies. I saw bones sticking out of flesh. I saw brains leaking out from heads and eyes that had been popped out of sockets. Bodily fluids dripped on my boots. I gagged at horrid smells. I jumped back when the swollen, bright red body of a drowned man belched up water and weeds.
That's very graphic. I can understand why it would have stayed with you. Why did you want to write about it?
Well, I was taking part in a creative writing seminar, which a former Marine volunteered to lead, and we had to write a piece of nonfiction, and this was the most important thing I had to write about. I'd been kind of planning and meaning to write about it for a while, and just felt like I needed to get this out of the way so that anything else could come.
Who are you writing this for?
I guess the first audience is the family of the actual Marines and soldiers that I saw and that I helped take care of. More than that, obviously, it's the families and loved ones of any service member who lost his life and or her life in Afghanistan or Iraq. And, of course, it's for the American public in general. It's just one more view on not only on the war, but just on the human experience. And, I mean, anybody who has lost a loved one or been around death can relate to it. I mean, when I wrote it, I didn't plan on having it published at all. It was very much for the few veterans of the class. It was just to share the experience with them. But people encouraged me to share it, and so I did.
Yeah. Was it difficult?
It's very difficult. For me, the most powerful things about the experience was that it was not at all about me, and I could completely forget. I did. I was not there except as a function of what I was doing. Mm. Whereas now that I'm sharing it, there's this public thing, and I have to be in the spotlight, which I'm not saying that I'm so modest that I can't appreciate as well, but there's definitely conflict there.
When did you leave the Marine Corps?
Officially July 1st of 2008.
So it's only been a short time.
It's been very short, yeah.
How do you spend Veterans Day?
Well, usually I call up other family members who are veterans. I guess this is the first time that I'll consider myself somewhat a veteran, even though it's not really the first thought that comes to mind. And this year it'll be special because I'll be at the book launching. So,
yes, the book is being launched on Veterans Day. Charlotte Brock is a former Marine Corps officer and a writer. Her essay, Hymn, appears in the book Powder, Writing by Women in the Ranks from Vietnam to Iraq. Charlotte, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Someone who would never give up the spotlight willingly is writer Sebastian Horsley. He's a self-described dandy and the author of the book Dandy in the Underworld. And for our series Three Books, Sebastian Horsley recommends books by authors with lots of panache.
I hate books. Where do I find all the time for not reading so many of them? But I do. The chief knowledge that a man gets from reading books is the knowledge that very few of them are worth reading. Writing is a long, painful, and appallingly styleless process. It takes you away from people. Writers that I admire are those who have transcended their medium and made sure that they themselves displayed more style than their mere creations. Quentin Crisp, Andy Warhol, Lord Byron. Their personalities touch the imagination even more intimately than their work. Books are only things, but writers are individuals. Of course, they all have a dash of vulgarity. Who, without an element of vulgarity, can become a work of art? Quentin Crisp is one of the greatest dandies ever to have lived. The Naked Civil Servant has an aching creative heart. It is a book about narcissism and negation, vitality and vulnerability, grandiosity and humility. It is the book of a warrior. A dandy who throws down a perfume gauntlet and fights a hostile world. And all in the most exquisite prose and clothes. In an expanding universe, time is on the side of the outcast. To justify its existence, writing has to be extraordinary. If it's ordinary, it's less than worthless. It's clutter. Profundity, popularity and profitability are rare bedfellows in art. In Andy Warhol's From A to B and Back Again, we have it all. This great book unbalances you. It disarms you and suggests ways of being and even aspects of behaviour. Warhol is transcendent trash. One foot in heaven, the other in Woolworths. As for Byron, as a thinker, he was almost on the level of a child. And who cares about those poems, sissy stuff that rhymes? That is not why we adore him. It's the glamour of his arrogance, the romantic disarray, the melancholic grandeur. A compulsive gambler, an ardent womanizer who excelled at reducing life to grand absurdity. Deformity is daring, he says in The Deformed Transformed. Style is knowing who you are, what you want to say, and not giving a damn. Writing usually describes the unlived life. It is a lonely and private substitute for experience. Crisp, Warhol and Byron knew that it is necessary to have known strong passions in order to depict them. They valued the impulses of the heart above social convention. They have a dizzying glamour. In these writers, beauty is the glove into which charisma slipped its hand.
Sebastian Horsley is the author of Dandy in the Underworld. He recommended these three books, The Naked Civil Servant by Quentin Crisp, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol by Andy Warhol, and The Deformed Transformed by Lord Byron.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.